at times I was at training and I could feel myself struggling and I'd almost have to like kick myself into gear and almost like turn my frown upside down and like, you know, physically fake it.
Whether it's the clothes you wear to work or a metaphor for putting up a front, we all wear a uniform. But often there's a lot going on behind the uniform, and many of us are reluctant to express how we are really feeling.
Each week on Behind the Uniform, Dr. Izzy Smith and Captain Hugo Tuvey will be joined by a special guest as they talk openly and honestly about their experiences with mental health. Nothing will be off limits, so prepare yourself for tears, laughter and goosebumps.
Welcome back, everyone, to Behind the Uniform. I'm Hugo, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Izzy. Welcome back, Izzy.
Thanks for that introduction, Hugo.
Wonderful. I thought I'd mix it up this week. And this week, we've got a special guest. His name is Moses Enriquez. He's an Australian cricketer. He's currently the captain of the Sydney Sixers. He's played Test cricket, One Day cricket and 2020 cricket for his country, Australia. He's also captain of New South Wales. He's also the proud father to little Archie, also an avid dog lover, I understand, with little Morph and the Golden Retriever, which I love my dogs too, Moses. That's something we have in common. But also you're a brave mental health advocate, and that's what today's episode's all about, really. But we really appreciate you taking your time to sit down with us and have a chat today, Moses, and hopefully I got your last name right.
You did. You're pretty good. Thanks, Hugo. Thanks, Izzy, for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
And before we get started today, guys, it is important that I issue a trigger warning. We are going to touch on some heavy topics, including suicide, mental health, and some other potentially distressing material. This may be triggering or confronting for some listeners, and if this is you, please know help is available and Lifeline can be contacted 24/7 on 13 11 14.
Thanks for that, Izzy. And look, Moses, mate, we just want to get you here today and really just talk about your cricket journey, but also, you know, more relevant to this podcast, your mental health struggles. And I think it was pretty brave of you recently coming open with that. So we might actually start there and really delve into during your early days with cricket. And when do you think you really noticed or understood your mental health, really, and when you thought that maybe this is something I might need help with?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, as a professional athlete, we get educated on, I guess, warning signs of, you know, mental health. And I do remember early on in my 20s when we did like a mental health education session, a lady came in and spoke to the whole squad. And I remember she did the presentation and there was a whole bunch of like symptoms that were up on the screen or the PowerPoint presentation. I was looking at the presentation going, I felt that before. And like not to the extreme level at that stage, but I definitely felt like dipped into some of those symptoms at different times. I'd never felt that for an ongoing period of time or for like high volumes of it. So that was a little bit of a wake-up call for me, because I was always this like really confident teenager kid that sort of felt like, oh, no matter what happens, I'll sort it out, I'll figure it out, and I'll outsmart it. And
which I think is most, you know, teenage kids. We do often think we're invincible and that, you know, nothing could happen to us. Even when I was young, I heard about, you know, doctors struggling with their mental health and I just rolled my eyes. Like, that would never happen to me. So I think it's pretty common to feel like that.
I think you're spot on. It's like I wasn't even paying this, like, presentation my full attention, because I thought even at that time I was like, oh, I'll outsmart this. Yeah. Like, I don't need this. Like, I'll outsmart it myself and, you know, I'll figure out a way around it.
But you know what? It's interesting you say that. I think that's the like you were saying, is the attitude with a lot of people. And I think, you know, even if it's something like any health thing, you know, whether it's cancer or mental illness, often people think, oh, it's never going to affect me. I'll be fine. And you kind of brush it to the side. But something like mental illness is obviously so common. And when did you go from those sort of feelings or understanding, hey, I have been feeling like that, to really realizing? I know that your father obviously struggled a little bit with that. So has it been in the family, do you think, or what was your understanding growing up?
Well, my parents got divorced when I was like 11 or 12, and I think my dad sort of went into that sort of, you know, below the line of the mental health post that, and, you know, never really got out of it. Where I think for me, when I became really aware of, I guess, that I was actually genuinely struggling was probably in my mid to late 20s, when I started sort of, you know, waking up in the morning with no energy, not wanting to train, not wanting to do things. And all of a sudden I had this like fear of, you know, not doing well at cricket, and all these things, where I didn't really have that in my late teens and early 20s. I was just pretty sort of happy-go-lucky, a little reckless kind of thing. But then all of a sudden in my mid to late 20s, I had this sort of fear of failure, so to speak, or this, and I started worrying a lot about the future and spending a lot of time in the future, you know, trying to fix problems that hadn't arrived yet, and became like very gloomy, you know, lost a lot of my personality, felt like I wasn't engaging with people socially as well. Like I was there physically, but maybe, you know, I would have a conversation with someone and walk away. I'd have no idea what, you know, what we just exchanged, if that makes sense.
And I can't help but chip in, is Dr. Izzy here. And those symptoms that you're expressing are very clear of, you know, more severe depression. That's depersonalization, you know, feeling like, you know, you're there physically, but feeling like you're, you know, in the corner of the room. And that loss of motivation and, you know, not wanting to get out of bed in the morning. It's interesting you said when you were maybe in your mid-20s and you were in that speech and, you know, ticked off some of the symptoms. What, like, I'm thinking that's probably more maybe some mild depression, and then in your later 20s it became more severe. Can you tell us a little bit about what were those mild symptoms, you know, when you were in that speech and you realised you ticked off a few of them? What were the mild ones?
I think there was like sort of, there were moments where I spent a little bit of time worrying about the future. There was also, so it's just some sort of minor anxiety stuff around, not really around performance or anything like that, but just in general. The other thing was I've never really been a great sleeper. So that, and in terms of, I always felt like I didn't need much sleep to get up and, you know, go and do whatever I needed to do the next day. And I woke up a lot.
These symptoms you're talking about, did you think at the time, though, that that was just normal?
I thought 100% it was just normal. I didn't even consider that any of those things were not, or like, I just thought that everyone had them, and probably most people had them worse than I did. So I was like, oh, I've got it pretty good here, so I shouldn't complain.
It's just amazing how we don't realise how bad things are until you're on the other side. I know I used to wake up in the middle of the night and go for power walks at 1 a.m. to manage my anxiety, and I now look back and I'm like, yeah, that's probably not normal or very safe. And it sounds like you had some experiences like that, and also a lot of physical symptoms. You said you lost weight and couldn't sleep. Could you explain that a little bit more about the kind of physical side of your depression?
I guess once it got really bad, so even then when that's when I first started seeking professional help, when I started to delve in, when I started to notice some of the bigger, you know, the symptoms hanging around for longer periods of time and feeling it a little bit more acutely. But
and sorry, mate, on that, because this is conversational, I'm going to jump in there if I've got a point. But when you say that's when you started seeing professional help, but before then, did you start talking to your mates and people before that professional help, or was that professional help your first sort of reach out for help?
Yeah, my first reach out for help was definitely professional help. I didn't speak to any of my mates. I didn't speak to my family, coaches, or anything about any of that stuff. I thought, you know, I want to get on top of this, but I want to, you know, I don't really want anyone to know what I'm going through as well.
Do you think anyone did know what you were going through?
No.
Were you with your partner then?
Probably not when it first started, no.
So you decided to see, you know, a psychologist proactively? That was your, no one yeah. kind of pushed you to that?
No, yeah. But even then, I was seeing a psychologist for an hour once every 2 weeks, you know. And I look back now, knowing what it took for me to get out of, you know, to actually change my well-being and to change my behaviours and so on, it took a lot more than an hour every 2 weeks. Mm. So it's like I thought I was doing something about it, but really I was dedicating 60 hours a week on my physical health and 1 hour on my mental health, and I'm like...
Yeah, so it's so interesting you say that, mate, and I currently still see a psychologist and it's so spot on. Like every time I see her, even now, I walk out from the appointment thinking, this is great, I feel awesome, I've spoke about some really cool, you know, awesome... you know, important conversations.
Made and, some progress.
Yeah, made some progress. Then you feel like you're going back and you're doing it, and all of a sudden, like, life gets in the way, and a few days later you feel you're getting, you know, anxious with certain things.
Back
and worrying
into those
about,
same patterns of thinking.
Exactly. So you're right. Absolutely professional help is a great, great way to do it, but you also got to actually, you know, be yeah. proactive and do that stuff too.
And I found, I'm not sure about your experience, but with some of the better psychologists, they often give you, like, homework to do mm. and stuff, mm. like little tasks or habits to try and create when you're not seeing them for the hour every fortnight. And I found that type of help was probably a lot of the time even more beneficial than the hour that you spend with the therapist if you actually did it.
Which I think is what is really important, you saying if you actually did it, because you have to have enough motivation. You know, if you're feeling really, really down, some people might not have even have the motivation to do the homework booking to see a psychologist. And I guess it to me kind of speaks about our mental health system and... I don't know, for me, it's hard. People can only see someone an hour every fortnight. And if you are really struggling, if you don't have the support of family or friends, I don't know, it just doesn't seem enough to me.
Mm. No, it's a good point. And, you know, obviously, as he was touching on then, you know, it wasn't just, you know, they're the physical symptoms too. And then it got to the stage where you got that professional help and you started to sort of work on it. And this stage, you're saying you're sort of late-ish 20s? Sort
yeah, of. So when I first started getting professional help, I was late-ish 20s, maybe 27.
But this had been going on, though, really, for you know...
The smaller symptoms had been going on for a while. And then, like, my first attempt at professional help, I was like, I did it 3 or 4 times, and I think I performed well a few times. And it was like...
I love the cricketer coming in exactly. here. I performed yeah. well in my psychology session.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, I performed well at cricket, sorry. I don't mean in my psychology session.
Right, but it's interesting you said it, but it did improve your performance, though, in cricket as well.
Well, it didn't necessarily improve my performance, but I feel like once I had a couple of good performances, it was a Band-Aid for my problems.
Those 4 psychology sessions have fixed 10 years of, you know, yeah, poor mental health.
That's right. Yeah. So once I, like... And because I'd relied on performances at that stage, maybe I relied on performances to just keep my mental health above the line mm. kind of thing. And once I had a couple of those, I was like, oh, I'm feeling good again. Like, I'm okay here. And I sort of got complacent with my mental health again. And sure as hell, once the cricket season stopped or something else or the performances stopped rolling in, then that doubt, like everything just came straight back in because I was always relying on external sort of stimulus for my own health.
We were talking before off mic, Moses, that you said, you know, often you've tied your self-worth as a person to your cricket performance, mm. which, you know, that's a very fragile position for anyone to be in, whether it's your cricket, your work, your relationship, because, you know, the cricket season ends or you could get an injury. Is that something that you've changed?
Yeah, definitely. I think as we spoke about earlier, I'm not sure I sort of tied it to my cricket performance, so to speak, but definitely where I sat in the cricket community, the sort of, and I was kind of like, well, irrelevant of how well I go, as long as I'm respected within the cricket community, you know, like I train hard, you know, I'll play under duress, like I'm a tough sort of competitor, then that's all that matters, you know?
And I guess that's relying on external validation.
Exactly. Exactly.
Rather than, you know, exactly. your own, you know, being happy with who you are as a person.
That's right.
Do you think that, you know, before we get into obviously some of the darker days and how bad it really got for you, you know, do you think that was partly the reason you didn't talk about it initially was because you had that sort of expectation being in that sort of public spotlight, Australian cricketer, and, you know, did you feel almost a bit embarrassed to talk to your teammates and to talk to other people to say, actually, I'm struggling here?
Yeah, I think so. And I think also at that stage, I might have been captaining both New South Wales and the Sixers. And in my head, I was like, well, you're supposed to be leading teams around here. And if anyone found out you were battling, like there's, you know, like you're not supposed to be feeling like this. So I just kept it all under wraps and trying to fix it in the background kind of thing.
Isn't that interesting now, though, because you talk about being the leader and leading from the front, whereas, you know, since you really have been more public and come out with it, now you're sort of that role model for so many people. People probably look at that as being brave, and you are still being an absolutely great leader with this way, but at the time you wouldn't have seen it that way.
It's incredible. I feel like what I've gone through and what I've learned has made me a 20 times better leader than what I was at the time when I was ignoring sort of my mental health because I thought I had to be a leader. I thought I had to be a certain way. I would have been a shocking captain for those couple of years.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a shocking person to play under in comparison to, I feel like, as a, you know, the captain I am now or the, you know, in the teams that I don't captain, the leader I can be in terms of, you know, the empathy I can, understanding I can show my fellow teammates that I probably didn't have at that stage because I was too busy worried about myself.
That's, yeah, I'm thinking you would have been putting in so much energy hiding how you were really feeling that you wouldn't have had any energy, you know, emotional energy to give to anyone else.
No, that's right. I would have had almost no understanding of other people's situations just because I was so caught up in how much I was battling kind of thing.
And interesting enough, the name of this show, Behind the Uniform, did you feel like at times you definitely were putting up that front and hiding behind that uniform?
Oh, big time, yeah. Massively. And, like, you know, there are even times where I was at training and at times I could feel myself struggling and I'd almost have to, like, kick myself into gear and almost, like, turn my frown upside down and, like, you know, physically fake it kind of thing.
And it's interesting, Moses, because, you know, I think it's so common for people to push their mental health to the side. And something I'm passionate about is, you know, prevention is better than the cure. You know, any health condition, whether it's, you know, a heart problem, I don't know, sore knee, the earlier you get onto it, the better. And if you keep ignoring it, it's just going to come back later. You kind of push your mental health to the side. And when was it, when you got professional help that first time, that it, you know, you pushed it aside for so long and then it had to kind of bubble over at some point? When did it really bubble over?
It probably got to a point where, well, my psychologist actually said that she referred me on to a psychiatrist because she thought there wasn't really much she could do for me anymore. And that would have been just before I took a couple of weeks off from cricket. And I'd let things get so far out of hand. And I think, like, it's such an interesting point you make about the prevention and the cure, because I've been trying to figure that sort of ratio, that equation out for years. And the problem that I've, like, from a personal point of view, because I didn't realize how bad it could get, and, you know, one little negative thought or one little thing here and one little thing there is normal, and I always thought I'd outsmart it, so I didn't really pay attention in those education sessions. And I can almost guarantee you all the young kids now that are in the same education sessions will probably be thinking the same thing. It's like, I don't really need to take notice of it. But once I actually hit the point of, I actually have to make change here, like, I can't function anymore. So once you're not functional, you understand that, oh, geez, maybe I should have listened 7 years ago.
And it's like, you know, if you have a twingy knee, like those little signs, you know, you do need to listen to them.
Yeah.
And that's all about learning how to be self-aware, you know, checking in on your own mental health, which I think a lot of people don't learn until after, you know, getting really low. And is that something that you do now, like being more aware of those small signs?
Definitely. I think after I had my son recently, there was a few weeks where I started to feel myself get a little bit clouded with worries about the future. I found myself, like, dipping into, you know, again, some of these symptoms again. And luckily I was able to, you know, realize what was happening because I'd learned from my previous experiences, and then sort of, again, like, doubled down on everything I was doing, you know, started allocating more time again to my mental health. And within, I'd say, four to five weeks, all of a sudden I was enjoying fatherhood, you know, and it was such a quick turnaround if you're aware and if you're able
to. You nipped it in the bud
early. And it was so much easier to do the earlier you can notice. You know, once, as just like a twingy knee, as you said, the earlier you get it, the easier it is to fix. So for me, it was kind of like, what got me back to feeling good again? And then let's try and keep some of those skills and things, education, whatever it might be, along the road to keep it all ticking on in the background. Because I, like, personally, I'm a little bit fearful of getting back to that state of where I was. I was like, I don't really ever want to go to that situation where I was before when I got really bad, and I don't want anyone.
Sounded like an absolute nightmare. Yeah. Of course you wouldn't.
No, and I really don't want anyone to get to that stage. I just remember being there and thinking I actually wouldn't have wished it on my worst enemy. Like, it's such a bad place to be in.
On that, mate, we might sort of just delve a little bit deeper into that. When you said, you know, you don't want to, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. So I suppose, you know, you had those sort of small symptoms sort of in your 20s. You realised it really progressed and you were sort of definitely suffering from depression. You eventually got that professional help. But during those worst days that you're just talking about then, and you don't want to go back there, you know, were you suicidal at times?
I don't think I ever, like, genuinely... No, I definitely didn't genuinely consider it as an option. I considered the consequences of it, of like what it would do to the people around me and so on. I genuinely considered running away from Australia and, like, you know, going and living off the land in Cambodia or something like that, and, you know, being a teacher somewhere and teaching English or something, like something where I could just get away from
this society. Sounded like an escape.
Yeah, an escape of some description. But I don't think I ever genuinely considered suicide as an option. There was a time when I was driving home from a cricket game where I deeply, like, went through the process of considering the consequences of what happened if I would crash the car at that time. When I was driving home that day, I remember I was in absolute tears and crying, and I was it was after the first day of a game, and we spent the whole day in the field, and I had three more days out there, and I was like, I've got to do what I just did today for another three more days. And funnily enough, now I love the thought of three more days in the field. Is crazy. It's like, the, you know, my change in perspective is just nuts. But I guess that actual feeling in the car, I remember crying, and then I remember, like, how can I avoid the next 3 days? What are my options? And, you know, that was one of my options. I didn't consider it very seriously, but I definitely considered it. And then considered, you know, what a... the effects of it on the people around me.
And often when we talk about, you know, suicide, I guess in our society it's still very taboo and it's still considered, often people think of it as a selfish act. I think for people, you know, I've been blessed, I've never had depression. It's hard to know how low you must be feeling, and for people to have insight into how you were then. I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, what would your thoughts be on people saying, you know, suicide is selfish, if... It sounds like you were in such a terrible place that you would have almost done anything to escape it.
To give you an idea, I guess I do remember considering it a few times, and I always actually considered it unselfish as the person suffering of depression, because I was like, at the moment I'm a huge resource drain on the people around me. So by the time I got to my lowest point, my wife knew, a couple of my close friends knew.
So you still managed before then to keep it hidden from most even, people in your life?
So before I saw the psychiatrist, the only person that knew was my partner. She was the only one that knew, but everyone was going to eventually find out, because I was and I'd sort of come to terms, well, not everyone, but like my close friends and the people I work with. And I was like, I'm going to become such a resource drain on everyone. Like, you know, I'm grumpy. I don't want to be around anyone. I'm trying to avoid everything. I don't even want to play anymore. I don't want to do anything. It'd be easier for everyone if they didn't have to coddle to me, so to speak, if I wasn't there for them. Not there for them, sorry, if I wasn't there, because then they could just go about their own lives.
It just shows, you know, how irrational the mind is when it has severe depression.
Yeah.
You know, you can't think straight, and...
I just don't, like...
Must have been a scary place to be there.
Yeah. Anyone who thinks it's selfish is... I just find if someone's had the, you know, unfortunately done an act like that, I don't know what it would take, and you guys might be able to touch a little bit more on it. But, you know, I for me, I'd almost convince myself it'd be an unselfish act.
Well, it's interesting you say that, and, you know, you do hear that a lot, and, you know, I tragically lost my best mate to suicide. I never once looked at that as him being selfish. Mm. I felt so sorry for him that he's in that much pain.
Yeah.
And I can personally relate to it in the fact that although I've never been suicidal, I have been in deep, dark bouts of depression, and I've also gone through a couple bouts of cancer and lots of treatment and physical pain. But some of the mental pain I was going through and the way I was feeling mentally, and I just hated that. And you talk about, you know, not being able to see that light at the end of the tunnel. I look at that and that was a lot more painful than some of that physical pain to go through. So I guess to put that a bit of in perspective for people listening, people that go through that deep mental pain is bloody painful. And sometimes for some people, they only see that as, well, they want to get rid of that pain. It's their way out of experiencing that. And that's coming from someone who's gone through two bouts of cancer and treatment. Mm. So that might kind of put a bit of perspective and shine a bit of light on how bad it can make people feel when you're in that point.
I don't understand, can't even comprehend, you know, the battles that you would have had to go through while going through that physically, and then the challenges mentally as well. But the mental pain I suffered through depression was far greater than any of the physiological, you know, symptoms I had, in terms of, you know, that feeling of a squash ball being in your chest all the time, short of breath, increased heart rate, no sleep, loss of diet. I lost 10 kilos over like 3 weeks. I just shredded away.
10 kilos in 3 weeks?
In 3 weeks, yeah. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping.
And I actually read a powerful quote you had with that, when your housemate and fellow Sixes cricketer sort of saw you and said, "Mate, Mozzie, mate, you're looking ripped at the beach."
Yeah.
And, you know, your muscles and six pack showing. And then, you know, you powerfully said, "Well, mate, no, it's actually depression."
Yeah. And he replied with, "Geez, I want to get me some depression."
My girlfriend and I.
Yeah, where do I get that, mate? I don't look like you.
My girlfriends and I talk about the breakup diet. Like, if we've gained a little bit of weight, we're like, we really need our boyfriends to dump us. Like, that's a guaranteed 5 kilos weight loss. And it's a bad joke. But I think it kind of shows.
It's a terrible joke.
Yeah. It shows, though, you just have no idea what's going on with people, like, unless you ask. And, you know, mate, you've lived in the spotlight. You have a life which is enviable. And, you know, some themes that I've picked up in the past is that you almost felt guilty for feeling depressed because, you know, you were living your dreams. And I think it's so important to talk about how depression doesn't discriminate. You know, so many super duper successful, you know, look at all these celebrities, you know, people that we envy their lives.
It doesn't care who you are or what you do.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the time, and again, shoot me down, this is just the theory, there's no science behind this one. But
no, I like the deep thinking. Go ahead, I like it.
Like, what I sort of, I guess for a lot of the time, I, as a kid, all I wanted was to reach what, you know, in social references, what I see on social media as a successful life, you know, like I wanted a nice car, a nice house, a nice family, to be successful at work and all this sort of stuff. And then all of a sudden I'd played for Australia. I had a nice car. I had a nice house. I had all this stuff that I thought was going to make me happy, and I still wasn't happy. I constantly tried to like negotiate with myself and say, your life's good. You know, wake up to yourself. Like, your life's great. You've got everything you wanted and stuff like that.
And you almost feel guilty when you're feeling like that.
Yeah. And then even acknowledging that life was good, I still couldn't avoid the fact that I spent all my time in the future worrying about losing everything I had anyway. So it was like, once I sort of started to develop a perspective of not even worrying about material things, because I'd realized that those things just didn't make you happy. And people, even now when I speak to people, they don't believe it. They're like, oh yeah, but if I had a slightly bigger wage and I could afford a slightly better house, if I had an extra bedroom, if I had a slightly faster car, that wouldn't make me happy. I was like, it would for a week.
And then you always want more. It's like getting the latest phone.
Exactly.
Or a new car. You love it for a little bit. Yeah. But then you kind of, you see another car drive past. It's like, they've got a better car than me.
That's
and
right.
It's interesting. We spoke to Brayton Astor on the previous episode about something similar with that mindset about the people think that that's the answer.
Yeah.
They think that will magically make them happy, but it's, you know, it's all materialistic, and it's actually finding happiness through other means and that's purpose, right, and feeling good on the inside that counts. Look, we might just I'm interested to hear your thoughts. So you've kind of gone through that journey of when you eventually got that professional help and some of the dark days that you really got. And this is all being done, remember, you know, in the public spotlight. You know, you didn't just have a private life. You were having press conferences and you were playing games for Australia and you tried to, like you said, in training, put on that fake smile. And you, at the same time, you tried to keep all of this hidden and you really did hide behind the uniform in a way. But what was it like when you finally had the, you know, I'd say courage, because it can be courage to talk to your teammates and those close to you and say, look, I have been struggling and I'm seeing professional help. And what was that like talking to your teammates about it?
It was, initially, it was really hard. I'd built it up to be, you know, I hadn't even decided what I was going to do. I took the time off and the physio, the doctor, the coach and myself were sort of weighing up options as to what we should say publicly. You know, should we say that you've just tweaked your groin again or something? So there was even this like, okay, we're still building up the stigma in the whole thing.
But as the person, that must have been horrible.
Well, at that time, I was like, yeah, I need that protection. Get me under here. Like, you know, give me. But then I like sat on it for an hour or two and I called him straight back and I said, no, like I need this. This is a step forward. Like I need to be honest about this. And like I missed the game because of this, because, you know, I felt like my mental health was not in a space to be, you know, functioning at that level. I guess then after the first game, I rang around a lot of the, you know, my closer friends within the team, and also sort of, you know, there was a pretty general sort of chat to the whole team about, I guess, what I chose to do. And then the reaction from my friends and the team in general was like, it just blew me away. It absolutely just blew me away.
Did it surprise you? Massively
surprised me.
In the support,
in the love, in the care.
And on that, what did you think was that? Like, what? It's interesting for people listening to this who are afraid of talking to people and letting their mates know because they don't know how they're going to react. What did you think their reaction was going to be like?
Well, I'd spent the last however long months and years thinking, if any of them found out, they'd think I'm weak or that I should just retire and give up if I'm not strong enough to cope with what, you know, the sport gives out. And the problem was I partly probably believed that myself, and that's, you know, that was the biggest issue. So I just thought other people would think the same thing of me at that time. And then once I spoke to them and they, you know, spoke to me in return and gave me their care, like straight away it just felt like this huge weight was lifted off my shoulders. I felt so much lighter straight away. Like I didn't have to hide anything anymore. Mm. You know, I must say I was pretty lucky. I had a pretty good bunch of guys and team and support staff and everything. But I think when you're honest and vulnerable with people, I've never spoken to anyone that said they've had a bad experience in sharing their, you know, vulnerabilities as a whole.
And isn't it a powerful point in that discovery and that journey and part of your story? And for people listening, it doesn't matter if you're an athlete or, you know, playing sport or whatever you do, it's a reminder to show that if you've got those close to you and those friends who are your close friends or your family members, often, like you had, the perception of, you know, I'm weak and people are going to judge me for it. It's completely the opposite. They would have looked at you as going, mate, thanks for letting us know. Like, I'm here to support you.
Yeah.
And, like, if we think about if we had to write a list of attributes for why our friends like us and are friends with us, it's probably not going to be because he's strong and never talks about his feelings or his mental health.
Exactly right.
It's another point that I want to just touch on with that, the coming out to your teammates about your struggles. And something that we get, and actually on the drive here, we're talking about it, Izzy, and for jobs in general, a lot of people don't want to come clean, or not come clean, but admit that they're struggling or they're seeking professional help, or they don't even want to see professional help in the first place because they think it's going to impact their career. And you hear it all the time, and you think, you know, people, whether you're a CEO, you're a cricketer, you're a doctor, you're in the army, people think, well, if I'm struggling and I'm, you know, opening up and saying I'm not doing well, I've got depression, that's going to impact my career. Did you think that it was going to impact your career? Was that even on your mind? And then what would you say to people who have those thoughts?
I did think that. I definitely thought that. I didn't think it would 100%, but I thought there'd be a chance. Mm-hmm. Little did I know it was going to have a positive impact on my career, which it definitely has, and my life as it's like. But at the point, at that time, I was like, what do I do? Do I say, because, you know, I'm going to be looked at different. I'm going to, and then I was like, what's more important here? Your life or what people think of you in your job? Like, and I'd already learned at that stage that a good job, mind you, like, you know, I was living out my dream and I'd learned that that didn't make me happy. So, you know, playing for Australia or whatever, you know, playing for New South Wales and the Sydney Sixers, still wasn't an, like, it was all external stimulus. And like that still wasn't making, you know, making my life for me purposeful and happy and whatever. So it got to a point where I was like, well, the pros outweigh the cons here. I may get judged at work, but guess what? It's bloody worth it because I need to sort my life out here. I'm not happy and I want to be. I really want to be. So I just massively put a big priority on, you know, getting my mental health right. And then once that was right, or, you know, at a stage where I felt I could function again, then I'd try and, you know, cross whatever bridges I needed to.
Because, you know, we talk about success in society and, you know, is it successful being an Australian cricketer if you're bloody miserable?
Oh, Izzy, now we're really, like, this is exactly what I love talking about is, like, what people call success. Mm. It's like, what do you call, I just love the definition of, even in teams when we sit down and we talk about our team's values, you know, like, oh, we want to be a successful team. And I'm always the first one to put my hand up and go, okay, can we define what success is? It's like winning heaps of games. I was like, oh, is it really? Mm. Is that all success is? So we can win all these games at the possibly an opportunity cost of all these other things, whether it's relationships, friends, you know, being held like good competitors, all this sort of stuff. But as long as we win, we're successful. And that, I think that's really sad.
Mm. And what if someone asked you for a very sort of shortened summary of say, hey, Moses, mate, what is success for you?
Okay. So I guess for me, because of that whole, you know, I tried to create values for myself that I can judge myself on every day. And the first one for me that took me away from trying to be successful at things was, you know, my first point was trying to improve myself or learn something new every day. Mm-hmm. And the second one was to try and have a positive impact on anyone you come across throughout your day. So whether it's just an exchange of a small smile or when you're walking your dog or someone that's made you coffee, ask them how the day is.
I love this.
To have like a positive interaction with whoever it might be that you come across. And then obviously that stems into your friends and your relationships as well. But
it has such a positive impact on you.
Yeah, exactly. You get the benefit that they get.
How nice is it having a chat with someone at the coffee shop or, you know, smiling at someone as they walk past on the street?
Yeah. And then the third one, which is I thought I had to put in because, again, I think if you notice my language before, I said I was going to judge myself on these things every day. And my third one was, you know, being compassionate if I didn't tick off one and two. So that was really important for me as a bit of a sort of perfectionist. I always like, did you do this? Did you do that? And if you didn't do it, I got, you know, I got angry at myself or like work harder. You've got to be better. You've got to do this. And I think the third point of like reminding myself that it's okay. You didn't get it done today, but there's always tomorrow.
Bloody good point you raise that. I think people can often be their hardest critics. And from the sounds of it, you can be quite critical on yourself.
Yeah.
So it's great to hear that third point, you are trying actively to be compassionate. And I just wanted to touch on that when, you know, you clearly like to help other people. And since sharing your story, and we're just talking about that, when you found that, yes, your teammates were not only supportive, and it obviously made you feel good, big weight lifted off your shoulders, but have you since had other people as a result of that reach out to you saying, mate, you opening up and sharing your story about your struggles has helped me, or whether it be other teammates or people through social media, have you found that a big part of your journey and other people sort of saying, thanks, mate, for opening up?
Yeah, I definitely have. It's been like, it's been really touching to see, you know, I guess the one of the greatest feelings you can get from someone is someone saying thank you to you for something you've done. And I get no greater sense of value than when someone says thank you, whether it's just because I went and got them a coffee and they just show their gratitude for something that, you know, I may have done or may have made their day a little bit better. Like, that's better than any reward anyone could, you know, ever give me.
Well, you've made our day coming on the podcast.
Thanks, so. Mate. But, like, that sort of expression of gratitude towards something that you did or spoke about, you know, really has a really positive effect on me. And I think anyone, and there has been a lot of people on social media, even stopping on the street to say, mate, I really, you know, wow. I listened to this or I heard that, and I, you know, there's so many of the stuff, so many of the things that you spoke about, I felt the same way. And it's nice to know that there are other people, you know, that sort of
people feeling like they're not alone.
Yeah.
That's really powerful.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've helped a lot of people feel like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people have helped me feel like that in return as well. You know, just from them sort of expressing it back to me, them saying thank you again, it's another sort of, it's reassurance for me to go, okay, well, I definitely wasn't alone, you know, in the struggle. I've got all these fellow people that are going through very similar things.
And now, mate, you mentioned as well that your partner and your wife has been an amazing support throughout this whole journey of yours, and she's basically been your rock. And do you have any sort of teammates or any other people that have kind of just been there for you, and, you know, people that you can kind of continually rely on, and someone who's there for you that other people listening could find that as well with someone that they can always
remember. Yeah, I mean, once they became aware or once I told them, I've had quite a fair few friends that have, like, you know, constantly checked in and, you know, just taken a much greater interest in, I guess, you know, having those deeper conversations as well, not just, you know, how you going, how's the weather, what you do on the weekend, you know, that actual the engaging conversation. And I think maybe because I did share that, you know, share my story and my struggles, I'm finding, to answer another one of your early questions, you know, not only the people on the street and on social media wanting to chat to me and say thank you, but a lot of my teammates, a lot of people from junior teams or pathway teams or even other teams that we play against will come to me and ask sort of, did you feel this? I think I'm going through something similar and all this sort of stuff. So it's just amazing to see across how many different industries that, you know,
ripple effect.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's everywhere. The attitude has changed a lot in 10 years or 15 years, definitely since I started playing around sort of mental health and, like, you know, it's definitely a lot more welcoming to talk about it, but there's still
that, especially amongst men.
Yeah. But there's still that, I still feel like to work up the courage to tell your friends that you're struggling, to actually say something, is like, you're a lot more accepting of other people's mental health, but you're still not that much more accepting of your own.
Yeah. And on that, mate, like, now we start to sort of move into towards the end of this episode and some sort of key take homes with that. And I'd be interested, you say that exact point. Last night I had someone I'd reach out. I didn't know her, but she reached out. I did a presentation. She was talking about how she was really struggling. And I said, have you told anyone? And she said, well, no, I'm really scared to talk to people. So what would you say to those people who are struggling and they're keeping it sort of closed in and they're scared or they don't want to tell people because they're worried? And then also someone who's been through it, been on the other side, what would you say to friends or family who might be noticing someone, and what's the right things they can also say?
There's no advice that's perfect for everyone. We're all on similar journeys, but I can definitely speak from my own experience that it was single-handedly one of the most powerful things I did. In terms of my career, in terms of my life and my own happiness, it was the best thing I ever did, and it was like the start of the road back, basically. You know, once I started to actually felt comfortable enough being honest with other people about, my own struggles.
That
was definitely the start of a positive return.
And like you touched on earlier, no one ever regrets.
No, I've not spoken to anyone that said, I wish I didn't tell my friends and family.
I wish I just kept struggling in pain and silence.
Because it's amazing how if it's not the help that they can provide in support and love and whatever, it's definitely, you know, what it does for you and the weight that it lifts off your own shoulders, knowing that, you know, they don't actually, you know, they're not judging me. They don't think less of me.
And then what about those on the outside?
Exactly.
What can they then do to if they notice someone struggling?
I just encourage, again, there's no perfect answer, but I would encourage engaging conversations. So, you know, if you feel like someone's struggling, rather than just, hey, mate, how are you going? How's the weather? How's the missus? How's the, you know, how's your boyfriend? Mm. You know, like get into it. Ask some deeper questions and you know.
Part of our one-liners of this podcast is we need to get comfortable with the uncomfortable.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I love that saying.
I think I learned it in a spin class when she's like, go on, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. I'm like, that's a good mental health one-liner.
Yeah. But it's so
it
true
really
and ask how they're really going and how often do you hear the, and you probably said it countless and countless times during those darker days, like, hey, mate, how you going? Yeah, good, mate. Good, mate. It's just a common answer, but actually kind of getting deeper in that. So, no, look, I do love that as well. And look, as I guess it's talking about the sort of take-homes as well before we start to sort of wrap things up, mate. We know your time's valuable. So we'll do you still see professional help at the moment?
I'm not seeing any professional help at the moment, but I'm still dedicating 20, 30 hours a week to my mental health in terms of education and, you know, reading and all that sort of stuff.
And that point there, what is some of those key things that you are doing, dedicating to your mental health, that's not only helped you through those real darker times, but something you'll probably continue to do for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, okay. So I guess for, I meditate maybe 3 times a day, and I did keep a gratitude journal probably for 2 years, and it got to the point with my gratitude journal, I might be going for too long here, but
no, go
my gratitude journal, I sort of, when I first started, I had to fake it almost. Like when I sat down and wrote down what I should have been grateful for that day, I really struggled to find anything despite, I didn't even remember because, you know, I couldn't remember the good things that happened to me.
You couldn't find one thing.
Yeah. I couldn't, I was like, well, I had a shocking day, this and that, nothing was good. And then I had to actually start writing what I should have been grateful for, not what I was actually grateful for. And then within a few months, I started catching myself out in those moments throughout the day. Oh, you know, thank you for doing that for me. Like I appreciate, I didn't even notice those people were doing that when I was at my, you know, at my.
And sorry, the neuroscience of this is really interesting. It shows when you were in those really dark times, your brain was wired to look at all of the negatives.
That's right.
That's what was, you know, firing up your neurons. And by doing the gratitude diary, first you were faking it.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, setting down those pathways of looking at the positives. And then as you continue with the gratitude diary, it wires your brain to be looking for the good things because you're like, okay, I need to go home tonight and write 3 good things in my gratitude diary. So your brain is, you know, it's looking for the positives. And then you start doing that without even realizing. You appreciate the sunny day. So that's, I think people think gratitude diary is a little bit airy-fairy sometimes, but it really is rewiring your brain to look at the world in a positive light.
I truly believe that having gone through that transformation firsthand, and I ended up learning through another course that I did online that, you know, that sort of rewiring of the brain is, you know, but I witnessed those effects firsthand. Within 6 to 9 months, I was writing 1.5 hours in my gratitude journal, and nothing had changed in my life in terms of I was still a cricketer, still at the same, like, you know, in the same relationship, same car, same house, same everything. Like nothing had changed other than my perspective.
And also, Matt, I've got to ask you as well, because I'm a dog lover, your golden retriever, Morton, I mentioned that little intro, but have you found something like that? You know, whether I find dogs, they're just always happy. They're always wagging their tail. They're never in bad moods. I found for me, my little recovery dog, Ernie helped me. But do you find your Morton's helped you along your journey?
Well, he was, I mean, even through my struggle, he was sometimes the only breath of fresh air I had to get that sort of, you know, when his tail was wagging, whether I walked home into the house gloomy or happy, you know, his tail was always wagging, happy to see me. So that was, he always gave me some positive feedback, which was fantastic. And that just ongoing, that's just, you know, that, I guess that unconditional love that they have for you. And you end up just returning it back in spades. I mean, he sleeps next to me every single night now. He gets spooned.
On the bed?
On the bed.
Oh, yeah. I'm exactly the same. Amber and I actually got a, we, my partner and I got a king size bed. And the main reason was so we had a bit more room for Ernie. So he sometimes, he's even got it. Sometimes he uses my little silk pillowcase and lies in the middle of us. So I'm sorry
you for you guys are crazy. I sleep like a starfish by myself in my double bed.
I love it. No, it's great to hear that, mate. And, you know, I suppose before we do look to finish up, you're still playing cricket.
Yeah.
You're still playing for the Sydney Sixers.
Yeah.
I love seeing the big win last year and hopefully get another back-to-back this year. Still playing for New South Wales, which is awesome. But what does life look for you sort of after cricket or post-cricket?
Look, I have no idea exactly what it looks like. You know, I've recently gone back to and started studying again.
What are you studying?
I'm studying business at AGSM, so a whole bunch of different courses, or subjects, I should say. But I don't really know exactly what path I want to go down post-cricket career. And I think you spoke about it just a second ago of that sort of being comfortable in the uncomfortable.
Yeah,
like, because for so long I've tried to control what my future looks like. So at the moment I'm just trying to learn as much as I can and do as much as I can to keep as many options open as possible.
Love
really.
It.
And it's amazing, I'm sure, when you were, you know, depressed, that uncertainty would have been terrible. But now that you're not, it's exciting and positive that
exactly.
You, yeah.
I was terrified.
But yeah. we'll still see you in the, you know, the Sixers pinks and the behind, you know, bowling a few seamers, mate, and making some runs for the foreseeable future.
Well, you're definitely still, if I'm performing well enough, you're still seeing me there. Whether, you know, good performance
whether
follows.
You're making runs.
Yeah, whether I'm making runs or taking wickets, that's an uncontrollable at this stage.
That's
but
right.
I'll definitely be doing everything I can to make sure I'm playing as well as I can.
And Moses, if I was going to summarise everything that's helped you in your mental health journey, it seems like you've, you know, completely changed your perspective about what success is and not relying on external validation.
That's right.
It seems like you've really learned about the importance of gratitude and giving back to others, and also being very proactive and self-aware with your mental health. Is there any other, you know, for our listeners, a few other take-homes of things that have really helped you to be in, you know, a great place that you seem to be in today?
So where I was getting to with the gratitude journal was kind of, I ended up having to scrap that physically because I was taking so much time, you know, physically writing everything I was grateful for. So now I do a meditation that is like a gratitude meditation most evenings. And I've started meditating a lot where I do, you know, whether it's savory, gratefulness. And I quite enjoy savory as like something that.
Can you explain what savory meditation?
Yeah,
I mean, are you eating potato chips?
No,
or?
Well, that can be a way of doing it. But like, so gratitude's a little bit more retrospectful. So like at the end of the day, you go, what was I grateful for throughout the day? Where savory is like almost catching yourself in the moment. So actually in this moment enjoying the blue sky or actually in this moment enjoying the food you're eating or the skill you're doing.
Sounds like mindfulness.
Yeah, a bit more sort of that mindfulness where like gratitude's at the end of the day or after an act you say thank you for doing something or whatever it might be. But I guess the savoury piece is a little bit more of that constant awareness of the present moment, you know, and actually being able to enjoy it at the time rather than after. And I think both are equally as powerful, but that's another skill that I tried to work on a lot.
I love it. I might even try to do that myself. And on that, actually, mate, we do have a weekly challenge that we do, which we set ourselves, our listeners, but also our guests. And the challenge is basically in line with what we've also been speaking about. And when you sort of, you know, your mates reached out to you and you also reach out to your mates, it's sort of the behind the uniform challenge. And it's basically someone or a mate who you haven't spoken to or heard from in a while. And we've all got someone, you know, whether it's a schoolmate, workmate, whatever, and just kind of reaching out to them, whether it's a phone call, text, and it's kind of our challenge to you. And we try and get all our guests to do it and all our listeners to do it. So hopefully you found someone there. But we also set ourselves that last one. Izzy, how did you go with your challenge from last week?
It was good. I spoke with someone that I went to university with and they had also taken a year off, a bit of a wellbeing year, and I talked to them about how I'd also taken a year off and they said it was, you know, really great to talk to someone because no one in medicine does that. We're all too scared to say we don't love medicine so much that we just want to be there every day. And yeah, so I think that was really nice. And I haven't spoken to them since, you know, over 5 years ago.
Awesome.
So.
No, that's awesome.
Week one.
Tick.
What about you, Hugo?
Yeah, look, and I reached out to a mate. I've got a mate of mine who's currently overseas on a deployment, and I've probably been a bit slack, to be honest, and I haven't heard from him in a while. And I realised after our conversation with going, hang on, I probably need to reach out to him, and I did reach out to him. We've now organised a bit of a FaceTime as well, which is awesome. So I think it's great. Sometimes we just need that reminder, and you never know, reaching out to these types of people, it would mean the world to them. So hopefully you're on board that challenge, mate.
Oh, definitely on board. And that is something I've been trying to do for, you know, it was definitely one of the things that I started doing when I was struggling as well, reaching out to people that I hadn't heard from because I'd closed down, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's such a great challenge. And I'm sure I'll find someone to do it for this week.
No, I love it.
Great. I'll try and squeeze in some meditations. My best friend is always nagging me to meditate more. So,
well, that was our other. We like our guests giving us some challenges to work on too. And throughout this sort of last hour or so, you have so many amazing sort of powerful tools that you have helped you. And from the gratitude diary to your meditation stuff to your dog, everyone can go out there and buy a dog. I think
not everyone can buy a dog. I would do anything to have a dog.
True.
But Dr. Lifestyle just doesn't.
But what's one challenge that we can do ourselves from you? That you think's a cool one, and we will do it, and we kind of give ourselves the week to try and just try it. What's something you can give us?
First, I wanted to ask, have you heard back from the, like, has that opened up a continual line of communication with the people you reached out to? Or
yes.
Was it just a one-off call?
No, absolutely it has. And now we've spoken since then. Like I said, we've even organised that FaceTime, and it's great to connect.
Isn't it?
And hopefully our listeners can do the same, and then we can all create that ripple effect.
Because that's fantastic.
It's awesome.
Mine was probably a one-off.
For now.
But I think it's, you know, we all only have 24 hours in a day, and, you know, it's okay to have friends that you only speak to once or twice a year. They're still really valuable connections.
So. 100%. 100%. Okay, so my challenge for you guys.
I hope it's not eat McDonald's for breakfast.
No.
I'll take that challenge. What do I sign?
Would be to set yourself some values. So you've probably all done it for you in the company teams or like at work or whatever, what you want to stand for or who you want to be as a company or as a team. But set your own sort of personal value and how, like, you know, what you want to be.
I love that.
So it can be, you know, one or two sentences. Try and keep it brief and I like to have it something that you can measure either daily or weekly or something like that.
I love that.
I really, really love that. And for anyone that's listening, I would love you to also follow Moses' challenge.
Yeah.
And if you're brave enough, maybe even, you know, put them on your social media and tag us, your three values that you'll try and live by each week.
Yeah, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, tag Moses as well. And Hugo and I will talk about ours next week.
No, I love it. I'll absolutely be doing that. And that's what we want the listeners to be a part of that journey. So, you know, we set you a challenge, you're setting us a challenge, but ultimately it's all to do with the whole positive mental health and some of the amazing stuff you've spoken about this episode. So look, mate, Moses, we really do appreciate you coming here and opening up and really delving deep in some of these conversations. I always learn so much from Izzy and I love it. I'll probably continue to always learn stuff, but also I've learned so much from you too, mate. And, you know, you talk about the amazing leadership you had as a cricketer, representing sort of, you know, New South Wales and the Sixers in the Big Bash. But also I look at you as someone who's a leader to other, not only young athletes, but young people in general who look at someone like you who's gone behind the uniform, showing the power of vulnerability, spoken about how you're really feeling and look where you are now with you know, you're doing so many amazing things, mate. So I really love you opening up to us and sharing your story.
Thanks, Hugo. And I must say the feelings are very mutual for both you guys. You know, you're both obviously very well established in your own lines of work, and to be delving into this subject, you know, I think the exact same thing of you guys that you guys may think of probably a lot of your guests that you have on here. So I really appreciate it, and it's been a great, you know, learning hour for me as well.